Hello, everybody. It's Gary Stuckey here, ready for another interview today on Real Music. I've got an awesome guitar player with a brand new album coming out. His name is Jack Starr of Jack Starr's Burning Star. You might know him from Virgin Steel, that awesome heavy metal band from way back in the day. And he went solo after that, and he's still doing it these days. And the album's coming out on July 15th. It's called Souls of the Innocent. And he's going to be talking about that and his career and so much more. Had a great time talking to him. So here he is. Here's Jack Starr.
Hello, this is Gary.
Yeah, hi, Gary. This is Jack Starr.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, man. How's everything down in Alabama?
Not too shabby. It's hot. Is it hot down there?
Yeah, it's hot too. we're in Florida. I plead guilty. We're very hot today.
Yeah, it's close to 100 here. I don't know how hot it is over there.
I think you got us beat. I think we're only in the 90s.
Wow. Who would have thunk that? Yeah, we'd be hotter than.
Go ahead, man.
Yeah, so what's been happening?
Well, I'm very excited. You know, we got this new album coming out, and response so far has been real good.
Awesome. And the new album is Souls of the Innocent, right? Coming out?
That's it. That's coming out on the 15th of July.
Awesome. And so you're pretty excited. So when's the last time you had an album out?
Actually, it was about like 4.5 years ago. The last album was called Stand Your Ground, and that came out about 4.5, almost 5 years ago. Yeah.
So during all this pandemic stuff and all that going on, it was probably a good thing to record and do some stuff like that. So tell me about the recording processes and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say anything good about the pandemic, but at least we had plenty of time, you know, when everybody was hunkered down. You know, we were hunkered down and we were making albums. We did the whole album, Souls of the Innocent, during the pandemic. And I think it had maybe an effect on the gloom and doomy kind of vibe to the album.
Right.
And I also did a solo album during that time. So I had a lot of time and I was really busy, and it was like, you know, darn it, I'm not going to let something like a worldwide pandemic stand in my way.
Yeah, right. and really, it helps out, you know, because they want to listen to music. You know, music takes their mind off a lot of that stuff. So they look at all the fans are like, man, I got something new from Jack Starr. You know, that's pretty cool, right?
Yeah, no, that's a good point, man. You know, music really is a great escape valve for a lot of people. And so that's cool, you know, that it exists.
Yeah, right. Music is always good. But you've been doing music, been playing guitar for a long time. So who were some of your influences growing up?
Well, I'll tell you, when I started off, I really listened to a lot of blues, you know, like B.B. King and Albert King and all that stuff. And then I got into Hendrix and Santana, and maybe a little bit before then I got into Johnny Winter and Alvin Lee from the band 10 Years After.
Awesome.
Yeah, so those are really like my big influences.
And so growing up listening to those influences, you know, you like, I want to get a band going. So what was one of the first bands you started back in the day?
Oh man, that's going back a while, but I'll tell you, there was a band called Vanilla Fudge. I don't know if you remember them.
Yeah.
You know, they had a hit with, you know, You Keep Me Hanging On and all that.
That's right. That's
anyway,
right.
Anyway, when they broke up, the keyboard player, Mark Stein, started a band with a friend of mine who was 15 years old at the time. And they called themselves Cynthia Fever.
Oh, cool.
And I thought that was a cool name for a band, you know, because Alice Cooper was out, and that was, you know, a chick's name, you know.
Yeah.
There was no Alice Cooper.
Right.
In Alice Cooper, and then I thought, well, you know, what did I know? I was like 16, 17 years old. I didn't know anything. So I thought, well, you know what? One of the songs on Mark Stein's Boomerang album is called Cynthia Fever. So let's make that the name of our band. And that was really the very first band I ever had.
Awesome. Yeah. Going back to those days, I'm sure you're just starting out. You don't really know, how to do things and stuff like that. I guess you get experience from playing in different bands and stuff like that. So I guess once you really got out there and started playing, how cool was it for people, like crowds, to start recognizing you and getting to know you, your playing style and just, you being in bands? How was that?
Well, it was really a good thing. Because I wasn't like an athlete in high school, I wasn't like 6'2" and buff and, going to go out and have chicks dig me because, I scored a touchdown last Friday night. So, and I did want chicks to dig me. I still do, but now I've succeeded. I've got a nice, very nice fiance and I'm, that's never been a problem in the last 40 years.
That's good.
But back then in high school, it was like, damn, how am I gonna like talk to this girl?
Right.
And I had a thing for hot looking, beautiful women. I don't know.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah. So
me too.
Yeah, there you go, brother. So I figured maybe if I learn how to play an instrument and put together a band, that'll be a good way of meeting them. And sure enough, it was. So music comes through in a lot of different ways.
Yes, it sure does. So you were playing around for a while, and you ended up forming a band called Virgin Steel. So how did that start?
Yeah, that was actually my second or third band, but that's the one that got me noticed. Well, I was sitting around one day on Long Island, New York, where I was originally from, before I moved to Florida. Anyway, I'm sitting around and I'm reading my favorite magazine, which wasn't Playboy and it wasn't Penthouse.
Right.
It was Guitar Player. Because my idea of a centerfold was a beautiful picture of like a Les Paul, a Gibson Les Paul, right, or a Fender Stratocaster. I'd be hanging those pictures up in my room and all that. And anyway, so I'm reading Guitar Player, and I see an advertisement, and it says something like, "Do you have what it takes? Do you think you're good enough? Can your playing be good enough to be on U.S. Metal Volume 2?
Right.
And it was like, "We're looking for America's best unsung guitar players."
Right.
So I'm thinking, oh, so I don't have to be famous. I just have to be good. And I just have to beat out like a thousand other guitar players that are going to send in their tapes.
Yeah, no big deal.
No big deal, right. So, and I was kind of, cocky and, full of myself back then. And I was crazy enough to think I had a shot.
Right.
And sure enough, I sent it in. And then like a week or two later, I get a call. And it's like, "Hello, is this Jack Starr? This is Mike Varney of U.S. Metal." And I didn't even really remember I sent it in. But then I was like, oh, damn, this is it, man. The guy's calling me back. So he, he's from California, so he's got this like, "Dude, you play great."
Whoa.
So I'm just going, "Yeah, thank you, dude." And it was really cool. We had a good conversation. Basically, he just said, "Look, I was really impressed with your playing, and we're going to put you on this album." And so that album, I have to say, was really the springboard, the jumping off place that really put me on the national map.
Right.
So then it wasn't just like, "Hey, you're really good for Huntington, Long Island," or "You're really good for Long Island," but it was like, "Hey, you're really good, and this is on a national level." Right. And that was cool, you know. That was, you know, everybody wants to be patted on the back and told they're good, you know.
Well, yeah. And it does help if you are actually good. So, you know, that really helps out.
Oh, I appreciate that.
So, the Virgin Steel, you had some famous fans of that band, like some guys from Metallica and Queensryche. Did I hear that right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't go so far as to say they're fans, but yeah, you know, they did appreciate, you know, Verbalize. Like for instance, we were playing a big festival in France in 1984 or 85. And Virgin Steel was on the bill, and Ozzy was headlining. There was Dio, there was Whitesnake, Gary Moore, a whole bunch of really great people. And then towards the lower third of the bill was Metallica and Virgin Steel and a band called Tokyo Blade and some, you know, some other bands that weren't really quite known yet, you know. And so anyway, we're back in our tents. You know, they had these tents backstage. And then two of the guys in one of the other unknown bands, Metallica, because they weren't really, you know, when I say unknown, no, they weren't totally unknown. But, you know, they weren't, you know, Ozzy or Whitesnake, you know.
Right.
So, you know, we were kind of like just, you know, bands that were like on the bottom half of the bill, you know. And so we were all in our little tents backstage. It was a big festival. And they came by, it was Cliff Burton, who was the bass player who passed away, and the guitar player, my memory sucks, the guy with the curly black hair.
Kirk Hammett, right?
Yeah, Kirk Hammett.
Yeah.
And they came by, and we were talking to them, you know, and then I think Cliff or him or both of them said that they really liked this song on the first Virgin Steel album, a song that I wrote called Children of the Storm. And so that was really cool. And it didn't really mean anything to me back then. It was like, okay, well, that's cool. You know, they're in the same boat we're in, you know,
right
now, you know, with the passage of time, it's like, wow, hey, you know, right. That's cool.
It really is. It really
that,
is.
That they, you know, gave us that compliment. And so the next thing is, man, I hope they use it one day on one of their, like, garage rock albums. You know, they did that album where they were, you know, doing songs from bands that, you know, they were influenced by or whatever. You know, do you remember that?
Yeah, the Garage Days Revisited. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So who knows, you know? If I keep talking about it, maybe they'll surprise me.
You're
know?
Right.
Do a remake. And then the other one with Queensryche was simply that when we were, like, before Virgin Steel won the very first album we did, before we got signed to a proper label, you know, like a big label, you know, yeah. Like in England,
right.
And in Europe and so on, we were doing it ourselves. We pressed the album up ourselves, and we were like, we have, like, you know, like 500 albums in the trunk of our car, and we were going to record stores, you know, and convincing them to buy them. And one of the things that I was doing is I was actually calling up record stores in different parts of the country,
right.
And seeing if they would, you know, take the record. And I don't know, one day, for whatever reason, I called up a record store called Easy Street Records in Bellevue, Washington. And I'm talking to the owners, Kim and Frank Harris, who later turned out to be Queensryche managers. Anyway, I'm talking to them, and I'm just saying, hey, you know, we got a band. I know you haven't heard of us, but we don't suck because the guitar player got on our guitar player Shrapnel album. I wasn't even saying that I was the guitar player because, you know,
right.
I didn't want to sound like I was, like, you know, like, you know, conceited or something. I'm just saying, the guitar player, Jack Starr,
yeah,
you know.
That's pretty smart, yeah.
Yeah, he got on this compilation album, so at the very least, you're going to like the guitar playing. So anyway, so they ordered like 50 of them, and they were talking, you know, because I just got friendly with them, you know, and they're saying, oh, by the way, we manage this band, and they're kind of like doing the same kind of music you guys are doing, and they're totally unknown, just like you guys, and they're doing a self-made album, just like you guys, and they have a singer that has a really, really good 4-octave range, like your singer. So I, of course, my curiosity was piqued. You know, it's like, what are they called? You know, and, can you send me, you know, their album, their demo tape, whatever it was, you know. So they did, and then there was a nice letter also in the package from the guys in Queensryche and saying how much they liked our album. And that was cool because I wrote Kim and Frank back, the owners, their managers, you know, the owners of Easy Street.
Right.
And I said, man, you know, the band you're managing is really, like, great, you know, these guys are awesome. And I actually helped get them their first record deal with a very small indie label on Long Island because they had like, nothing at the time. And so I got them a deal with a label that we were dealing with called Dutch East India Records. And those records are pretty collectible.
Wow.
Because they were only on that label for about, I think, a month and a half, and then EMI bought out the contract.
Oh, wow. Those are rare, so, I'm sure.
Yeah, so they were thrilled, you know. They just bypassed that whole indie scene really, really quickly.
Right.
And just got on the majors. And we did as well, because when Virgin Steel put out the album, we started getting offers from, like, labels like Music for Nations, which, you know, signed Metallica, and they signed Merciful Fate and Rat. They were a British label. And so our album, Virgin Steel 1, actually is also MFN number 1, which is Music for Nations number 1. And then we also got signed to King Records in Japan and Roadrunner Records for the what's called the Benelux countries, which is Holland and Luxembourg, and you know, so it was like pretty cool. We started developing like this big worldwide following, but we didn't get the what's the word I'm looking for? We didn't get the gold bar, you know, like in Willy Wonka. What is it?
The golden ticket.
We didn't get the golden ticket like Metallica and Queensryche did, but at least we got a very good, you know, loyal cult following all over the world.
Yeah.
So I'm not complaining. We did a lot better than most of the people that I grew up with.
And you influenced a lot of guys too over the years to listen to you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, I'll be like surprised and I'll look on an liner notes of an album, you know, and they'll talk about bands that, you know, they liked or grew up listening to. That makes me feel real old, but I don't care. It would be like, you know, like Hammerfall mentioned us, and the band Rhapsody from Italy mentioned us. So we definitely had an impact, and I think that we were right there at the beginning of this like new style of music that they call epic metal,
right,
or power metal. And we were right there at the beginning in 81, and we really helped define that whole sound, you know, the look of it, the sound of it, even the album cover art, the whole thing, you know. So I start thinking, wow, I must be really old because I always get referred to like as a pioneer of power metal and epic metal.
you're supposed to be talking like, back in my day, we, you know.
Yeah.
We used to have.
Yeah, back in my day, give me my Walker, you know.
You're right. Yeah. You were talking about the album covers, the late, great Ken Kelly, right? With the
Yes, art. Exactly. That's who I was referencing. And he did the last three Burning Star albums, and he was just phenomenal. Now, this new album, we didn't have Ken do the cover, just simply because we wanted to just try something different, you know. And unfortunately, Ken passed away a very short time ago, like I think a month ago.
Right. Sad to say, yeah.
Yeah. And he was great. And he also, I would definitely have to say, you know, helped define that whole genre of music, because, you know, his artwork on, you know, on albums like Rainbow Rising and
right.
Kiss Destroyer and all that, and Man of War, all really helped define like that style of artwork that became synonymous with, you know, epic and power metal.
Right.
And even our first album cover way back with Virgin Steel, which was designed by an unknown, just captured the fancy of a lot of young metalheads across America, you know, just seeing that spaceship with that weird creature.
Yeah, right.
And if you look carefully on the album, you'll see in small letters on the side of the spaceship, it says NWOHM, which means the New Wave of American Heavy Metal.
Oh, cool.
So we put that right on there, and not everybody caught it because it was kind of in small letters. People just thought it was just some kind of like weird military insignia, but that's what it meant.
Wow, I had to go check that out. I didn't realize that. That's but you started a lot of that stuff in the band Virgin Steel. So y'all were going pretty well. So why did you decide to leave that band back after?
Well, it was kind of like a mutual decision, you know. We went about as far as we could, in my opinion, and we were just becoming more, I would say, different with our musical tastes. I was more into everything being guitar oriented, because I play guitar probably.
Yeah.
And less keyboard driven, you know, and more a direct kind of bang your head, heavy power chords and minor melodies and things like that. And Dave, who was the other alpha male in the band, because I think we were both a little bit, you know, kind of headstrong, and we wanted our vision to prevail.
Of course.
You know, his thing was he wanted, you know, more keyboards and more time changes, more complex music, which was cool because I like that as well, but not as much as Dave. And so he was writing, his writing was going in one direction, my writing was going another direction. And then I got an offer to do a solo album, and it was a big offer. And I said, you know what, I'm going to do it. And then when I get back from doing it, I'll go back and rejoin Virgin Steel, and we'll take off, you know, where we left off. But unfortunately, that wasn't to be, because sometimes you can't go back, you know, and there was ruffled feathers and everything else. And there was a new manager that got involved who was very happy to see me out of the picture.
Oh, wow.
The guy was, this guy, Zoran Buzik from Canada. He managed a band that called Saga, which had like a hit in the 80s. I don't know. Does that ring a bell at all?
It does ring a bell. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, they had a hit called, I think it was called Turn It Loose or Turn Me Loose or, I'm sorry, it's called Tonight We're on the Loose.
Okay.
And anyway, so I contacted actually Zoran about managing Virgin Steel. This was right before my solo album, because we were kind of spinning our wheels. We had gotten, you know, all this acclaim, all these newspaper articles everywhere in the world. We were like 200 different metal magazines, and our albums were on all kinds of labels, you know, because we didn't sign to one monolithic label. We signed to actually like six or seven labels,
right,
each one, you know, covering a certain territory. So, and I think we were spinning our wheels, and I really wanted like a big time manager, somebody who can get MTV rotation, which he was able to pull off for his band Saga. So I contacted him, and he got back to me, and he said he really liked the band a lot, and he'd be interested in working with us. And I didn't think anything of it, you know, for a while. And then I noticed that that Dave and the boys in the band were becoming more and more kind of, I don't know, like kind of aloof, you know, like kind of like almost like they were didn't really want to talk to me, and right. they were doing their own thing, and then I was putting two and two together, and I felt that, okay, this isn't good, you know, the band isn't going to last, and they're going to probably go off with Zorn, and that's exactly what they did, and I think Zorn was happy to get rid of me, because I was the oldest guy in the band, and I was also... at the time making all the business decisions and doing all the, the licensing of the album right. and publishing deals and all that stuff. And, so he figured, well, you know, let's get rid of Jack Starr, cause he's going to be a thorn in my side, and I'll be able to control the band a hell of a lot better without him in it. And they'll find another guitar player, and that'll be that. And that was that, and we broke up, and it wasn't an amiable breakup. It was like Dave and I were not good breaker uppers.
Oh, yeah.
So there was a lot of like back and forth, you know, you suck, no, you suck, blah blah blah, right. and lawyers got involved and everything else, and. Now, with the passage of time, you know, I look back on it, and, you know, everything happens for a reason.
Sure. It does.
And I'm happy with where my musical direction has gone, and I'm making these really great albums. I mean, without blowing my own horn too much, just the last, like, three or four albums have been really good and really well produced, and, you know, we spend a lot of money on the recordings. We don't use, like, electronic drums or... We don't take shortcuts. In fact, and we don't put them out in like 2 or 3 years. You know, usually they take like 4 or 5 years to make.
Right.
And I think it shows in just the care and the crafting of these albums.
Well, how when back in the day, you know, when you were playing music, you know, and Virgin Steel, things like that. I mean, there were so many bands out there. You know, and you were saying y'all didn't ever get that golden ticket. What do you think was really the reason that you could have maybe, if you're looking back, what would you have done differently to up the game and maybe get the golden ticket? How would you do that?
Yeah, I think a couple of things done differently, but I would have to say at the top of the list, really just getting a really good producer. We didn't have a really good producer. We didn't have a guy like Mutt Lang or somebody just telling us, hey, guys, stop being so effing self-indulgent.
Right.
Get rid of the guitar solo at the intro. You're going to do one later on.
Right.
Get rid of those four-octave piercing screams all over the place. Repeat parts a little bit more often.
Right.
Make the choruses beefier. Nobody was telling us that. So we were like kind of like kids in the candy store. And so our records had this rawness, which was cool with the underground, you know, cult metal and the 15-year-old kid in his mom's basement
right.
digging the album. But right. it wasn't cool getting radio play and getting MTV play
right.
and you know, that thing, which... really results in the golden ticket or platinum albums.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So I would really say the producer was really the number one thing, because those albums could have easily have turned into multi-platinum albums with a producer, with somebody to say, get rid of that intro guitar solo. You
right.
don't start a song with a screaming guitar solo, you know,
right, right.
get rid of those high octave, you know, screams in every other verse,
right.
get rid of all that stuff, make the songs more streamlined, you know, but we didn't have that.
Right.
So, you know, so in retrospect, I would say to somebody starting out, get a good producer and, listen to other people, including people that know nothing about music, because those people will probably be more helpful.
Yeah.
Like, you know, parents even.
Sure.
You know, like if you play the, your first album and your mom says, why is the singer screaming all over the place?
Right.
Take a hint. It might be too much.
Right.
If a girl you're trying to impress in high school, you play your demo tape and she says, why is there all this crazy guitar playing all over the place?
Right.
Take a hint. That's if you want to be, you know, a gold selling have a gold selling album.
That's right. That's right.
So I would say a lot of it was our immaturity and then lack of a producer, you know. But that said, we still persevered, and I definitely I definitely don't know any better. I'm still doing it, and I love it. And my initial fans have stuck with me, so it's a good thing.
That's a real good thing, right?
Yeah, man.
And so tell me about the new album, some of the songs on there, and what, you know, how did you get these ideas for the songs and what kind of songs you got on there?
Well, this I have to say is really one of our best albums. I co-wrote a lot of the songs with the bass player in the band, Ned Maloney, who's been with me for, God, 100 years at least. And he's just a phenomenal bass player and a great collaborator. He has a very methodical kind of mind. Mm-hmm. He likes to have everything organized and everything has to make sense. And you need somebody like that in the songwriting process. You can't get carried away and just put things in the song just because you think they're cool.
Right.
The whole song has to be cohesive and has to make sense. So having Ned at my side, you know, as a collaborator is great because he also is a great arranger. I think the role of arranger, you know, in rock music is really really super important. And back then, like in the music, before rock became the big thing, arrangers were very commonplace in music. They don't really exist so much in music anymore. And what I mean by that is just somebody that finds the blueprint for the song, lays it out, and tells everyone, this is how we're going to do it.
Right.
You know, let's say in the case of Twisted Sister, whoever arranged that song was really smart. We're not going to take it.
Right.
They said, okay, we're going to come in with the chorus real strong.
That's right.
Then we're going to introduce the instruments. Then we're going to go into the first verse. And then when we go into the lead solo, we're going to paraphrase the melody again. So instead of just doing a crazy lead solo, you know, where the guitar player shows off,
right,
they go into a lead solo that sounds like, you know, down, 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 down.
Right.
That sounds like the melody.
Right.
So that was really good arranging, good songwriting, and ditto for a lot of these other bands, you know, like Van Halen and so on. Just great songwriting, great arranging, and I think our last couple of albums really have that as well. And it's all a learning curve, you know, music. And so if you're willing to learn, and if your ego is accepting, you know, if you don't have a really big ego where you can listen to other people's input, you're going to make quality stuff. But you have to be a team player.
Right. And that's something you learn as you've been in bands, right, that how to get along with the other guys in the band. But I guess it's different these days than it used to be back in the day, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it's a collaborative effort, you know. And, I mean, we're also super lucky. We have an incredible drummer. He played in an 80s band called Manowar.
Yeah.
Which was like one of the heaviest, you know, bands on the planet. So he brings to the table this very, very heavy way of playing drums, which is great. And so the band really is a very collaborative effort. And it's like we can't help but make good sounding records at this point, you know.
Right. That's the idea. And, you know, the fans, though, that have been around all these years, how would you say this album is comparable to your previous work and even Virgin Steel? Is it in that vein, or would you say totally different?
I think honestly, if we had put this album out in 1984 just the way it is with no changes whatsoever, we would be looking at a double platinum album. So, it's like, yeah, absolutely. You know, just the actual sound of it. You know, the production values, the bigness of the drum sound. You know, it's like really huge. The choruses, the vocal sounds, the guitar sounds. Speaking of guitar, the co-producer on this album is a guy named Kevin Burns, and he's a phenomenal guitar player himself. He has he's actually worked with Don Dokken. He recorded with Don Dokken, wow. And he has a studio. And in the studio, he's got all the greatest, you know, amplifiers that you could find in 2022. He's got, like, amplifiers made by a German company called Bogner. Oh, yeah. And it's just, like, really great, great equipment. And he turned us on to something that I didn't even know existed 4 or 5 years ago. It's called reamping.
Yeah.
So what that means is you send the studio or the producer the files, and you send the guitar tracks without all the embellishments, without the distortion and the delay and all this.
Right.
And basically, you let the producer put all that stuff on and reamp it through another amplifier or a couple of amplifiers, and the result is like magic. Wow. It's like, but it's still you that played it, and if the tracks weren't good to begin with, they still wouldn't be good. But what it is it's taking your clean tracks and giving them world-class, production values. So all those things combined, if we had put that out, you know, way back then, it definitely would have been a platinum album. And, but back then, we couldn't afford $1 million studio.
Sure.
We were actually recording in a very good studio, and it was really expensive, but it wasn't like the record plant in Sausalito or the power station in New York City.
Right.
It wasn't like one of the top studios where, let's say, Ozzy would be recording, or even Queensryche when they got their deal, or Metallica, you know, after they signed to Elektra.
Right.
So once those bands, you know, hit major label status, they were able to really have a budget and really, really put out these incredible sounding albums. And they left a lot of the smaller bands, you know, they kind of left them behind sound wise because, you know, when you have Bob Rock producing your album like Metallica did, and you're spending like a year or two in a studio that costs like $150 an hour.
Yeah.
You're going to come out with a good product, even including all the wasted time and all the drinking and everything else. You're still going to come out with an incredible album. So now we have that same opportunity in the last, like, I would say 4 or 5 years to compete on that level, just simply because of the digital age that enables us to send files and get that sound. I mean, the guitar sound that we have is equal to anybody's sound. The drum sound is equal to anybody's drum sound. Ditto for vocals, ditto for bass.
Right.
But we're not spending, you know, like $50 or $100 grand on an album.
That's right. Which, that helps, you know, when you don't have to pay that much, right?
Yeah, it does, especially when you don't have the $100 grand to spend on the album, you know?
Sure, sure. And speaking of the vocalists, who you got on vocals?
We're really happy. You said, are we happy with them?
Yeah, the guy who you got singing on the album?
We've got Alex Panza. After three albums, Todd decided to go off with another band and also to ignite his own solo career, right, which he did, and he was a contestant on The Voice.
That's right.
And so Todd went that way, and he's now singing in one of the original metal bands, a band that I actually really love called Riot. So we had some really big shoes to fill. It's like, okay, what the hell are we going to do now? We have this incredible singer is no longer with us.
Right.
So we really went on a big vocal search, and we found this guy. He's 29 years old. We're all old enough to be his father. Right. We found this 29-year-old guy from Turin, Italy, and he just, you know, blew our minds. He just had a really great sound, reminded us of Dio.
Awesome.
And he was also a big fan of Rhett Forster, the singer that I used on my first solo album, who incidentally was in Riot as well.
Right.
So everything comes around and goes around. And here's a funny little anecdote real quick. When we were playing in Germany at a festival like 8 years ago, you know, there was like a line of people that were online to get our autographs, and we were signing merchandise, you know, and so on. And there was this young guy, and he brought a bunch of stuff that he wanted me to sign, and he wanted Rhino, the drummer, to sign, and Ned to sign. And somebody took a picture of me signing something for this young guy who was like 21 or 22 at the time. Right. He looked like, honestly, like he was like 16, you know, but he was actually 22. So, so there's a picture of us. And that picture surfaced after we got Alex in the band. And it was like, oh my God, this guy wasn't kidding when he said he was a fan of Burning Star.
Wow.
Here's proof, you know.
Wow.
So it was a good thing.
That's awesome. Wow. So tell me about some tour dates and things like that. You got some of those coming up?
Yeah. The label that we're on, Global Rock, even though they're based in Europe out of England and Germany, they seem to be very interested in us playing in America. What a concept, right?
Yeah, you that's know? Cool.
Yeah, you're American and you're going to play in your own country. What a concept.
That helps.
But yeah, but that seems to be their concept, because I've been doing interviews for like the last 2.5-3 weeks, and it finally dawned on me today. My girlfriend and I were looking, you know, at all the past interviews and everything, and she noticed, being smarter than I am, she knows, hey, Jack, have you noticed that all these interviews are from places in America? And I just looked at it and I go, oh my God, you're right.
Wow.
And that was such a new thing for me and for Burning Star, because the previous like 3 or 4 albums, every interview was like either going to be in Holland or Italy or Germany or
right.
Czechoslovakia, I mean the Czech Republic, right. Russia, right. Japan. And I was doing all these interviews, you know, through Skype and also through Zoom and all that. And so we noticed, I don't know, man. I guess I'm not the sharpest cookie, the sharpest with the blade in the tool shed, because it took me like 3 weeks to notice that all these interviews we're doing are from places in America.
That's so funny.
So I'm thinking that, you know, hey, maybe that's part of their plan. They're going to want us to play in America, and I'm cool with that. That'll be a different thing for us.
That'd be real cool. You get some exposure for America and a lot of fans, you know, over here. But
and also North America, like Canada,
yeah,
because
sure.
I noticed there's a couple of interviews. There's one later on today that I'm doing, so it's kind of really cool that. That whole North America, you know, the United States and Canada. And who would have thunk it, you know, that we're coming full circle.
That's right. And you're not too far away from me right now. So, I mean, that's how close we are, right?
Yeah, absolutely, man. You know, Alabama borders Florida.
That's it. I'm probably about 15 miles from the border of Florida. So I'm right there.
So you're close to... what's that place where they have the NASCAR races?
Talladega. That's north of here. I'm in between Mobile and Montgomery, probably like 100 miles, something like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're not far at all. Yeah, you're definitely in driving range, you know. And I love all the places, you know, in Alabama, and just love it. You know, it's got that old southern charm, you know, and it's not like super crowded, which Florida sadly is becoming more and more crowded.
It sure is. I think you can't walk 2 feet without running into somebody. But yeah. It's true.
And half the time you're running into somebody from your old town, you know, on Long Island. It's like, wait a minute. Like, I came to get away from you. What are you doing here?
See, it's all those old timers coming down. Now, what do they call it? The snowbirds, right? Coming down.
Snowbirds. North. Well, I've been here like almost 20 years now. So.
But you're one of us down here in the South now. So
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, we're one of the people now that is like almost getting resentful. It's like, don't come anymore. We're good. The ship is full.
That's right. No more. Get off my lawn. but I appreciate you talking to me today. I'm looking forward to that album. I mean, awesome guitarist you are. I mean, I've been jamming. When I listen to, when I talk to the guys, when I interview everybody, I go back and get pumped up and I'll listen to the music. I'm like, man, stuff rocks. But I mean, that's what it's all about, though, the awesome music, right? And you're still around after all these years, keeping it going. Man, that's so
I'm
awesome.
A lifer. I'm like these guys in prison that are in there for life. I'm a lifer when it comes to heavy metal.
Hey, and that's a good that's a good thing, not like the other guys. But I appreciate you talking to me, and looking forward to hearing more stuff from you. Maybe see you out there one day.
Absolutely. It would be my honor, and I would love it. And just a shout out to all the metalheads in Alabama. Keep the metal burning.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much, Jack. Hello, everybody. Gary Stuckey here. Thanks for listening to another episode. I appreciate you taking the time to listen. And if you'd like to help out this podcast, you can do so by clicking on the support button and donating any amount of money that you feel like, and I appreciate it so much. And be sure to check out my YouTube channel, the same name, Real Music with Gary Stuckey. And thanks so much. And whatever you do, keep the music real.